Go. Today is an unimaginable privilege. I'm talking to Joy Zhao, who is a founder and manager of Wellington College in China and one of China's leading figures on education within the country and globally, one of the leading practitioners. And you have the relationship has changed Wellington forever. It's been, looking at our 165-year history, one of the most significant links. People will look back in 100 years' time and see the beginning of the relationship, Joy, with China as one of the most significant developments in our first 250 years of history. And absolutely rightly so, and you were at the heart of it. And we have gained and learned so much from you we are, Wellington is one of Britain's most pioneering and leading schools. You have made us different, you made us better. And we're going to be looking at all of that. And thank you for coming to the studio,
Anthony.
To Jukebox
yeah.
today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
To be talking to us. So the first part of what we're going to be talking about is you as a person. And you speak such beautiful English, better English, I feel, often than I speak myself. And, wow. and how did you learn to speak English so beautifully? And when did you first come to England? And why did you decide to come to university here? So just a bit about your early days.
Sure. So I was born and brought up in Shanghai in the 1970s. I did go to school in Shanghai. So the K-12 education I had was in schools in Shanghai. But my school specializes in good English teaching. So I went to a girls' school. Mm. It's called the Shanghai No. 3 Girls' School. But previously in the 1920s, it was established by missionaries from the U.S., from the U.S. church, in fact, as a religious school. So therefore, they had the tradition of teaching good English. So even though my English was reasonably good when I left China to come here, I came to Oxford to read computer science in the late 90s. My English was not what it is like now. Yeah. I still remember the language cultural shock when I first arrived in England, because our English textbook goes, "How do you do when you greet somebody?" Nobody said that to me. They were saying, "All right, everything well."
Maybe we should go back to saying, "How do you do?"
The very first time anybody said, "How do you do?" to me, you remember? It's many years later, decades later, that I met the Duke of Wellington himself, the current Duke of Wellington. And he did say, "How do you do?" And by then, I forgot how to answer. I should have said, "How do you do?" back. But So funny. English language. Which was, I only started learning English at age 11 from ABCD. So you could imagine the amount of effort that I needed to make to get my English level to what it is now. On the other hand, my two sons, Daniel and James, who are bilingual from birth, they just picked up English and Chinese effortlessly. And
isn't it funny the way that if you learn from the
from
very
childhood.
Beginning, from
babyhood,
it becomes so much easier. Had your parents, Joy, traveled to the West, traveled to England? And what was your first trip to Britain?
So when I traveled to Oxford was my first trip to Britain.
Goodness.
Prior to that, I only had one trip outside of China, and that was to Japan as an exchange student for a couple of weeks in my high school. My mother, however, did travel to the West prior. She was a visiting scholar as a physicist. She's a material physicist. So she graduated from Fudan University with a degree in physics, one of the most prestigious universities. She was very special in her days because for women to be educated to that level in the science subjects was quite rare. So she was a visiting scholar to the US for 2.5 years in her mid-30s. And therefore, she had the exposure to the Western world and Western education. She's always encouraged me to go out and see the world. And therefore, I was encouraged to pursue a possibility of doing my university study outside of China. I, in fact, had an offer from Oxford University and at the same time also an offer from Cornell in the US. I decided to come to the UK because Oxford, in my mind, was a better university.
So what was the impression when you were growing up of England and how do you do an Oxford as opposed to the US? What was the prevailing view in Shanghai of this country?
Of England versus US. England is seen as more traditional, slightly more reserved, and people care more about manner. And even down to, you know, school uniform, we're more formal. We do wear tie and jacket in the school uniform. In the US, it's seen as more diverse. So the US is seen as more diverse, perhaps more inclusive, but also a bigger country, but lots of different immigrants. Therefore, it is. So to, as a Chinese person going to the US, I certainly see a lot more Chinese people who have been there and settled for several generations. It's a vibrant economy, very innovative. England is more traditional. And there is a specific feel about England. But England is home to me, at least half a home to me, because my my husband Martin.
Well, how did you meet Martin? Tell us about that.
So I met Martin at college. So we were at Oriel together. He was a mathematician and I do computer science. So the science students do tend to mix together. So we were part of the same friendship group. So we were friends before we started dating.
And the experience of coming to Oxford from Shanghai, wasn't that quite a significant cultural shock? And what were the biggest cultural shocks?
I mean, language was a challenge. Language was a challenge. And people, Martin remembered when I first arrived, they remember me being very quiet. So I was probably mostly...
I can't imagine you being very quiet.
I was probably most listening, absorbing things and not saying very much for the first 3 to 6 months before I started feeling confident in expressing myself. So the language is the first barrier, and it's a big barrier. Imagine you going the other way. When you go to China, you know, the Chinese language would be overwhelming for most people. But also food. Food is very different in China versus in the UK. And I remember, especially with cold food like sandwich. Sandwich is quite common for lunch here. But in China, breakfast, lunch and dinner, they're all hot meals, usually with broth or soup, you know, some liquid and some sauce. And so sandwich being very cold and very dry is a difficult food for me to get used to. I used to eat it layer by layer. I eat the top layer of bread, then have the salad, then eat the meat, then finish with bread. So I got teased and laughed at. Food is another thing, and also the culture. So for example, the habit of students moving from the dinner hall, right next to it is the college bar. You know, after dinner, a lot of friends just walk to the bar, order a drink, and just sit there for a couple of hours chatting. So initially, I really was puzzled about what's this for? Because coming from the Chinese education system, we have such a heavy workload. The idea of you can just casually chat for a couple of hours on a weekday evening with no specific purpose was quite alien to me. So at Oxford, I would say, finally, this is the first time in my life my time is not scheduled fully. I had a lot of downtime that I could choose to do what I want to do. And I would say that's perhaps, for me, the most important aspect of the Oxford education, that I was given the space and time to figure out what it is that I want to do rather than what is on my timetable and what I should do. Prior to coming to Oxford, I did spend 1 year in a very good university, Tsinghua University in Beijing, in China. And the workload in Tsinghua, in terms of academic workload, I would say is at least double that of Oxford. Hence, I didn't have much time for socializing and drinking beer.
Or drinking warm English beer in Tsinghua. That's such a difference.
But that's the now in reflection, having been in education for 15 years now, in reflection, it's probably intentional the way Oxford structured itself so that, and also intentional how Wellington College encouraged students from a very young age to figure out who they are, what they want, what it is that they bring to the world, what it is that they can do. I felt that coming through the Chinese education, I perhaps wasn't given as much room and time to think about that. We all worked very hard. In order to have academic excellence in the Chinese Gaokao system, one almost have to work really, really full time, maybe 80 hours a week on academic study in the high school stage in order to excel at those exam at the end of it. It's survival of the fittest. So the work ethos and the commitment to education is amazing in China. Teachers have very high social status in the Chinese society.
Much higher than here. So let's come on to the second part of the discussion, Joy, which is when did you decide that you wanted to set up schools and in particular partner with a British school?
Yeah, indeed. My first part of the career was in the IT industry. So because I did a computer science degree, I got a job with Intel Corporation straight out of university. So I started with them in England, and then they moved me to Germany in Munich, and I moved with the same company back to Beijing. So I was in the IT industry for a decade. So many people ask me, how on earth did you get into education? That's a bit of a sharp career turn. And I would say that's very much triggered by a personal need that I had. So I started looking into international education in 2008 when my older boy Daniel was 3 years old. I was looking for nurseries for him in Beijing. And because I said Martin, my husband, is from England, he's not of Chinese heritage, so he is British through and through. So for us, having our children being brought up bilingually, biculturally, was not a nice to have. It's a must have. And therefore, in those days, international schools are still in its infancy in China. I was looking for a school that could I could indeed bring my children effortlessly bilingually in a multicultural setting. I didn't find the school that I wanted at the time. And also, I just finished my EMBA degree in
that?
China. That was with CEIBS, so China Europe International Business School, the best business school in Asia, set up by the European and Chinese government. Yep. I just did my EMBA degree. I had an entrepreneurial mind, and I thought, I just want to start my own business in something. And education was one of the considerations that I had. So I was young enough and naive enough to think that just because I needed something, I had an idea that I could make it happen. So I resigned from Intel and my pretty secure and well-paid job. So that was a big risk-taking and started exploring whether I could partner with somebody to start a school. And Anthony, you were a big part of that.
What happened? You could have been with any one of a number of schools.
And I think it was you. If it wasn't for you, I think this partnership might not have happened so quickly in the way it did. As you know, I got your contact from a mutual friend, an email address, and that's all I had. So I wrote an email to you to say, are you interested in partnering with somebody to open a school in China? Within 15 minutes, you replied.
Well, I do remember, Joy. Yeah. I mean, this shame on me. I was in a governor's meeting. I had my BlackBerry, who remembers BlackBerries, under the desk.
Yeah.
And I saw this message that came in. I thought, hello, this is interesting. Mm. And I flashed a message straight back to you. But we were not the only apple in your eye.
Not at the time. Yeah. Well, I didn't know how many people and how strong interest schools will have. But you replied within 15 minutes. And within a couple of hours, we were on the phone with each other. I didn't know you were in a governor's meeting. So you must have really made effort to get on the phone with me. And a week later, I jumped on a plane and came and met yourself and your board of governors, the subset of them. And I remember within a month or two, there was a visit to Tianjin by some representative of the college. Within 3 months, we signed the MOU. So it's true Anthony speed, I would say.
So I was thrilled because I thought this is the future of independent education. We had run a number of conferences at the time here at Wellington with members of government speaking at the Labour government and the royal family to try and encourage schools and universities and cultural organisations to set up abroad as a key element of soft power. And I was particularly intrigued by China, which I'd never been to at that time, Joy, but which I just thought that with our history and with the importance of China throughout history, what a privilege it would be to have that link. So tell us then how the story developed. You mentioned Tianjin.
Yes. So Tianjin was our first project, and we set up Wellington College in Tianjin that opened 2011. So we are celebrating the 15th anniversary. Wellington in Shanghai opened 2014, and Wellington College in Hangzhou opened 2018. By the way, all three of these Wellington colleges in the three different cities in China are now ranked number one international school in their city by the Huren ranking, which is the very influential international school ranking. So you can see we've come a long way in our size and quality just in a sheer 15 years' time.
And on a personal level, if part of the motive of joy was for your own two children. Tell us about their stories.
Yeah, so they had an amazing education at Wellington College in Shanghai. In fact, when I came into it, it's more from the business entrepreneurial side. I was not an educator by training. So the privilege of working with educational leaders and teachers so closely in building a school that is indeed the school for my two boys. They're now both grown up. So Daniel is now in his second year doing electrical engineering at Caltech in California. He is truly enjoying himself and flourishing, thriving and flourishing there. James is now waiting for his university offer. He just applied to university. He's in his senior year in a boarding school in the US. So they've both had an amazing Wellington College education. Looking back, I would say they turn out to be far better than I could ever imagine. Because I came from a very traditional, robust, academically rigorous Chinese system. The reason why I wanted Wellington was I wanted a holistic education where well-being and respect for the individual and the child is at the center of the education. And indeed, that is the ethos. That's why we clicked. I wanted a holistic education where the arts, the sports, you know, the services, understanding the world is as much part of the education as the exam outcome at the end or university destination. I will have to admit, having gone through the very rigorous Chinese system, seeing Daniel and James growing up at Wellington, when they were in primary school and lower part of the secondary school, I was slightly worried about them being too happy. They just didn't seem to be working.
That's unforgivable.
Yeah, I know.
That's terrible.
But that's very typical Chinese parents' thinking. We think in order to be learning, you ought to be just sitting at your desk working. You ought to be suffering. The more you suffer, the more you gain. You know, no pain, no gain. That's very much part of the learning culture in China. So I was slightly worried about them having too much free time when they were in primary and in the lower part of secondary school, and they did a lot of sports. So they're happy, they're always with their mates doing sports. They have all these trips, you know, Duke of Edinburgh trips. I just didn't see them doing homework very much. But they came through, you know, GCSE, then they, of course, moved to American boarding school because they were wanting to go to American universities. Their academic achievement is amazing. It's, you know, Daniel is a higher achiever in maths and science, far higher than I was.
It's and interesting.
Yeah, Wellington did that without making them suffer.
Wellington, the second top IB school for results in the world of larger schools, second in the world, and of course Oxford, first in the world, often despite not having that punishing work regime.
Yeah.
And so there's something there about a balanced life, and something there about flourishing and deep learning.
Yes,
that can happen, and helping people learn how to live. So, and just a word about those cities, Tianjin, known to many British people, less as the port of Beijing than where a missionary called Eric Liddell, who appeared in a famous film.
Chariot of Fire.
Indeed, I've interviewed David Putnam in this series who produced it, Chariot of Fire. And then Shanghai. How different was Shanghai now to the Shanghai that you grew up when you were a young girl? Just tell us about the cities.
Yeah, that's the transformation of the city as well as the country in general. It's an amazing transformation. When I was growing up, the initial accommodation I was born into for a family of four apparently was only 11 square meters. It's just one room. It's the living room, bedroom, everything together, with shared bathroom and kitchen facilities with the neighbors. I don't have memory of that particular property because I was too young. That was it for the whole family of four. And then we moved through maybe four or five different homes throughout my growing up, and each step gets better. And nowadays, if you visit China, the kind of homes that not even just families in our school, just average Chinese family live in, are modern, you know, always with heating, hot water, aircon, lifts. So within a mere 40 years, China has been transformed from one of the country with one of the lowest GDP per capita country to now a middle income country, especially in big cities like Tianjin, Shanghai, Hangzhou, Nantong, where we operate our schools. Indeed, people are enjoying, I would call them, a developed country standard of living. And in some areas, probably even more comfortable than in London.
And safer.
Safety is one of the things that many people talk about. So we have a lot of expat teachers who join us from all over the world, from 30 different countries, many of them from England, and especially female teachers. And if they're single, they can walk anywhere in any of our cities at 10 p.m. at night on a Saturday night without feeling threatened. So that safety is one of those things that people often, being safe and clean and prosperous and convenient. I mean, quite often people joke about before they come to China, they didn't know what to expect. In fact, for many of our staff, when they tell their family they're moving to China, they quite often get a shock from their family, you know, especially from parents. They'll go, gosh, why would you want to do that? Because I don't know what's the perception that a lot of British people have about China. Perhaps it's more of a lack of perception. Many people don't know what to expect. And
it is a remarkable country to visit. And even though they're not quite the sandwich bars there yet, I do remember the first time we went on that rocket train from Tianjin down to Shanghai. Yeah. You were very proud because you had in a box something that was new on that fast speed station, which was a pizza. So pizza, ubiquitous pizza now, that was 12, 15 years ago. There's so much that it is an extraordinary country to visit. But just say a bit more about the expansion up to six schools that we have today and what the big steps were there.
Yeah. So that's in, I mean, we have six schools in four different cities, three Wellington schools and three Heber schools. I'll talk a little bit more about the Heber schools in a moment. We have over 5,300 pupils now, 1,400 members of staff. And all of these are not for my driving to want schools to happen. It just naturally happened that there is demand in these cities. We were approached by local governments to invite us to set up schools because we very quickly built up reputation of offering world-class international education in our schools. So people quite often ask me, you know, how aggressive did I have to be to build all these schools? I would say it's not from ambition or me being aggressive in expanding the business. It really is from the local growth in demand. And we, of course, had to work very hard to establish all these schools in this time. But because it's in the backdrop of the rapid economic development in China and the rapid rise of the middle class, higher income families who have the ability, financial ability to afford a private premium, private international style education. In fact, when I came to Oxford, I was on a full scholarship. Mm. In those days, my parents' income would be nowhere near sufficient in supporting the tuition fee payment in Oxford. But nowadays, every year we send hundreds of family to universities in the US, in the UK. Vast majority of them are full fee paying students supported by their families. So even by that, that's just one generation. Even by that, you can get a sense of the scale and the speed of the development and the rapid improvement of quality of living in China. You talk about that bullet train that we went on. When we went on it, that was the only line. Mm. It was back in 2009, only line from Beijing to Tianjin, about 120 kilometers. Now, the network, bullet train network in China is 50,000 kilometers. 50,000 kilometers, which is, I just looked up on DeepSeek this morning, about 70% of the world's total. So of all the high-speed railway network that the world has, 70% of them are in China.
I am not going to mention HS2, which has only been going for 25 years. We're going to move on. Just to say a bit more about the Heber schools.
Yeah. So the first step of me wanting to set up Wellington was driven by the desire to have a British-style education, but happening in China. So I very much wanted the holistic education of Wellington. But the second step of Heber was when I realized there are a lot of things that are precious in the Chinese education system. We don't want to simply bring Wellington to China. We actually want the best of both worlds. We want the best of the Wellington ethos of the holistic education, intrinsic motivation, passion for the subject. But we also want the Chinese education ethos of valuing education, the work ethos, academic rigor, and the curriculum design in some subjects like Shanghai Maths, for example, is famous here in England.
Yeah, and right,
So we have subject experts at the national level designing these curriculum and standard textbooks for the whole nation. Therefore, the sequence, the rigor, the expectation is there. So the scaffolding, there is a very high baseline in the Chinese education system. It's much more free in the English system. If you're a good teacher, obviously it is brilliant. But if you have a new teacher who's not so experienced, not a lot of resources are available to them. So I wanted an education where it's a truly immersive bilingual education, where students learn both languages to the native standard level and immerse themselves in two languages in all the other subjects as well. So for example, Daniel and James, who went through the Wellington education, they do have Mandarin lessons and they have learned Mandarin to a first language standard, but all of their other subjects are taught in English. Therefore, they don't master the vocabulary of maths and science, of history or geography, in Chinese. So when they talk about certain specific subjects, they switch to English. I have the same problem. I can speak English relatively fluently in this setting, but if you ask me those specific technical vocabulary in English, I don't master that. But the Heber students, they do. So it's immersive bilingual.
And tell us about this experience. You could be driving through any of these cities, and then suddenly you come across something that looks like Wellington and Crowthorne. I don't know, I can't remember, Joy, how we came up with the idea that the schools were going to look like Wellington College, because I'd been to see a number of international schools, British schools that are set up, and they could have been anything. I mean, they could have been office block. They could have been office blocks. And I thought, no, if this is going to be truly, and building the Mandarin Center here was part of the reciprocity, only part of the reciprocity of it. But was that a good decision? I'd never asked you that question.
Well, I think, especially in our context.
And why have you replicated those designs of looking recognisably Wellington with lots of Wellington house names and so on there?
So it's about building bridges, isn't it? As I say, if you grow up with something in common, either language or food or pop culture, and in our case, the same uniform design, the same building, people then, they're used to this, they are comfortable with this. And that shows the connection. And sometimes those visual connections matter. And it gives people a sense of belonging, people of a sense of shared experiences. I just talked to a couple of Heber Shanghai graduates. They were studying in, they are studying in universities in London. They said actually coming from Heber Shanghai, coming to, you know, Imperial or UCL in London, they didn't feel there was any cultural shock. They felt the transition was seamless because they were taught by British teachers when they were in Shanghai, even down to furniture design, apparently. They said, that we even use the same furniture. So that's the kind of bridge that we're building.
It's a bit like, Joy, what you were saying there about if you can learn the language early, and what we're trying to do here is to build friendships early on with people when they're still in primary school age, and you get to understand, have a respect for the West or for Britain or and China, which then will be there for life. My experience of those people who are more, how am I going to say this, closed-minded, is that they've never traveled to these places and never had exposure. From the very earliest stage, they were always just with their own and didn't have that kind of cultural, international, linguistic and other experiences to become part of their personality formation. Let's move on to the third area, which is more general reflections on the cultural differences between both the countries and unpicking the stereotypical images that East and West has. How are the schools positively contributing? Because there are voices in Britain who, just being honest here, who say, don't want to have contacts with China, all kinds of reasons they'll come up with. But essentially, it's a sense of wanting to pull up the drawbridge and not to have any connection. And of course, there are difficulties. There are always difficulties between two countries. Between Britain and America, supposed to be our best friends, we have enormous difficulties. And that's, there are between friends, there are in marriages. That's not true. And the best thing is, you and I believe, it is to reach out and to build friends. Tell us about this.
Yeah, and that's the vision that we share, isn't it, Anthony? That's how we formed the partnership 15 years ago. You always saw the global perspective as an essential part of a Wellington College education. So you went out of your way in building those experiences into Wellington College students' learning journey here, you know, all those overseas trips, connection with similar age children outside of Britain. And we share that, we very much share that same vision. I think that's the unique strength of Wellington College education as a group, as a close this closely connected global family of schools, we indeed are in this privileged position of providing those opportunities for young people from different countries, different cultures, different languages, food preferences, to indeed grow up alongside each other, you know, having those in-person interactions, but many online interactions, so that they can share their perspective and differences and truly understand what life is like on the other side of the world. You talk about this fear or maybe mistrust or dislike of China from some people in Britain. And I always feel when it's an abstract concept, when it's a country that is so alien, so far away, when the language is so different, so that you can't, if you see it written down, you can't even guess what it means. In French, you can. In German, you can if you speak the English language. Yeah. So, and when the country is so recently developing, I mean, one of the challenges that we have for China is that fluent English speakers in China is a very small minority. You know, people who can speak English to the level I do is very, very rare in China. And that's part of the problem that we need to solve. Why are we misunderstood and have a lack of trust to China? It's probably because we're not doing a very good job yet in communicating to the rest of the world. And it's probably because there are not very many people who can. Because remember, China is only recently becoming a well-educated, well-developed country. You know, 40 years ago, we were still very poor. 60 years ago, we were extremely poor after the Second World War. So we built the country only recently. So it's only really one or two generation of people who have had an English education. And of those people, they're not taught by people who are fluent in English. So even the language barrier, I think it's a big part of it. How many Chinese people you meet that you don't get a good understanding of them because they can't speak the language. We have an induction program for our new teachers relocating to China, the cultural induction program. And we do say for your Chinese colleagues working alongside of you, many of them cannot speak English to a fluent level. Therefore, it's part of their induction, the Western teachers' induction coming to China, to remain patient and open-minded. Because if you grow up in England, never having met people from another culture, if somebody makes a grammatical mistake or a spelling mistake or who can't speak properly, you immediately think they're not intelligent or well-educated. So part of this global perspective, global understanding, is to train your mind to accept that sometimes people might speak with you with broken English, but they have a brilliant mind. They're intelligent. They have high level of integrity. They're hardworking. So the skill of to be able to connect to those people from a very different linguistic and cultural background and get the best out of them and to share different perspective and agree what is the best outcome for our pupils, those skills are bridge building, cultural bridge building. So even for the Western teachers who don't speak Chinese, by the time they work in China for three years, 5 years, they will come back a different person. They will come a better person, having understood the world much better. And I think that's my passion. You know, I talked about Wellington. I would say Wellington 1.0 is about bringing holistic education with well-being in China. 2.0 is the best of both worlds, East and West education system. Now we're very much in the 3.0 version of Wellington education in China is about East meets West, building cultural bridges between East and West. And when you look at this 21st century, this is the century where East is meeting West. And we would rather build educational, cultural links and bridges, solving differences and conflicts through dialogue, negotiation, rather than, you know, we would much rather using soft power and influence to solve our differences than resort to hard power. Because the world can't afford that with the technological development. I think we have to coexist on this earth as shared humanity.
And it's been said of you, Joy, that your ultimate aim in this this extraordinary impact you've had on China with the schools is to bring greater peace to the world.
Yeah, I say that, and to our senior leaders internally. Mm. I mean, if I go external to say Wellington College education is about world peace, people will think, oh, that's a bit cliche. But I do mean it in our own little way, because when you think about it, thousands of students that we educate in China now, when they come to London, they say there is no culture shock. They can connect, communicate, influence, and enjoy common interests with their British peer. And our students are doing this all over the world. They go to universities all over the world. Bit by bit, we're going to increase those understanding, mutual understanding and appreciation, form collaboration. I mean, the kind of business opportunity that you can have by mastering the Chinese language at an early age. Think about China's economy in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time. I mean, it's generally accepted that China is going to be the largest economy sometime during this century. Some people say, you know, by 2030, some people say by 2050. But if we have the next generation of leaders, not only from China, but also from Britain, from America, I'm starting a Heber Academy bilingual school in San Francisco. Yeah, in order to not as a school for overseas Chinese studying in San Francisco, but indeed I'm hoping to attract non-Chinese to learn the language and immerse in the culture from a young age.
You are supreme peace builder and bridge builder. And tell us more, just as we draw towards a close, Joy, what more the East, what more China has to offer the West and Britain specifically, and many people in England, Britain, the West, do not know that China used to be the most powerful country in the world and the most influential. And they think the printing press was discovered in Central Europe and not in China 100,000 years before and so on. I mean, there's still, but just tell us some of the things that is different about China to the West and from which we can learn.
Yeah.
And at least understand.
Yeah. For the past 18 out of those 20 centuries, China was the biggest economy in terms of GDP in the world. Many people don't know that.
They don't.
Yeah,
they
and so don't. People think China is this new kid on the block, you know, the coming out of nowhere. But for us Chinese people, we always have this pride of this deep-rooted history. It's the single largest continuous civilization on Earth. If I pick one thing about the key difference between the Eastern philosophy and the Western philosophy, I would say it's probably that between independence and interdependence, or put it in another word, is the individualism versus the collectivism. So in the Chinese culture, we are very much see ourselves as part of a bigger, part of something bigger than ourselves. So the expression of individualism is less encouraged, which is why quite often when you meet Chinese people, they're more reserved, not just because of linguistic ability. They are less willing to express their opinion. As a senior leader, if you want to get what they think, you truly need to draw it out of them. But that's part of the culture. We are less about us as an individual, less about expressing how I'm different from you. Harmony is much more valued in China because we live as a collective community. We would downplay our differences and dial up our commonalities in order to exist in harmony. So for example, a unique feature of the Western democracy is the multi-party system, isn't it? You have elections and you select which party you support. And in that, every party have to differentiate itself from others. What do you stand for? And what I stand for is very different from what you stand for. And then you have the risk of polarizing. You become more and more extreme in what you stand for. In China, we're a one-party one-party government. There are other parties who can be consultants or advisors to the government, but there is one party balancing the need and different views creating the harmony. That's usually what my friends in England feel most strongly about, the fact that they don't view China as a traditional liberal democracy. And we always say, I say in China, we view democracy in a different way. Democracy in the sense of the party or the government does make a significant effort to understand the needs and wants of the various different people in different parts of the country, in different social class of the country, and seek to provide the policy that addresses the majority of the people's needs for the longer term. And the benefit of that is stability and security. Security, you talked about. You don't have to walk on the streets and be worried about gun crime, for example, or violent crime. That's very, very rare in China. But also stability of policies. Recently, the Chinese government just released their 15th five-year plan. And every year, every time at the end of the five-year plan, they will do a quantifiable measure of to what extent we've achieved those plans. And this is why things like the bullet train network, renewable energy transformation, for example. China is now, in terms of manufacturing capacity for wind, solar, and lithium battery, we're probably 70-80% of manufacturing capacity. In terms of installed base, it's 50% of the world's total. So there are a lot of positives that you can have with a powerful long-term government, stable government, because they can influence transformation, influence policy in the long term, to the extent that a democracy, which typically changes government every 4 or 5 years, can't.
And of course, the aim here of our relationship is not to homogenize, not to put one system on the other, but to learn and to understand and to make friends and to respect difference. And how else can we do that unless we begin early with young people in formative learning experiences, learning about cultural differences, which have been there for decades, millennia. And that, as you say, Joy, will make one a better global citizen of the 21st century.
Indeed.
So just final thoughts there before we close down on that you would like to offer. What have we not talked about, Joy, that you would like to share with us?
No, I think I would echo what you just said. The reason why we communicate with each other is not to change who we are. So I'm not going to impose my preference on you. You know, Martin, my husband, is currently watching cricket in Sri Lanka. Cricket is a sport that he grew up with that I never understood.
But do you have any idea what you're missing?
Exactly. But we as a couple, we learn to coexist with our differences. We don't try to convince each other, you have to like my food, I have to like your sport. We actually live in harmony, accepting the differences. I think that's what we need as a world, isn't it? We can accept our differences, but still live in harmony. We have a saying in Chinese, "各美其美，美人之美，美美与共，天下大同," which kind of translate to every form of beauty is different. But you appreciate each other's beauty. Once you do that, then we can all thrive in harmony. So I think that's a very
wonderful moment to finish on. Even if you'll never be a lover of English sandwiches or 5-day cricket matches that last for 5 days and end in a draw with no one winning, which is a form of madness. You have said it beautifully there, and wonderful to finish on some Mandarin spoken as well. Joy, thank you.
Thank you, Anthony. The best is still to come. Thank you.
The best is still to come.